that the years of 18 through to 25 had changed so much in a couple of generations that he put forward a hypothesis that we needed to be recognizing that people in those ages were experiencing something quite different to what their parents, their grandparents, and certainly their great-grandparents had experienced.
You're listening
to the Thinking Matters podcast.
Conversations
at the intersection of
faith,
culture,
and reason.
I'm your host, Todd Funk, and today I'm glad to have and excited to have my friend Sam, Dr. Sam Bloor, with us. Sam, welcome to the podcast.
Hey, Todd. Nice to be here.
Those who don't know, I'll tell you a little bit about Sam. He graduated from Otago University with a degree in medicine and bioethics, and then he worked as a practicing doctor for 5 years before a kind of a gradual career shift into full-time pastoral ministry. He's earned his master's in pastoral theology and recently completed a doctorate in ministry at Fuller Theological. And he currently teaches as he works as a teaching pastor at St. Paul's and Simon Street. And Sam, that's quite a kind of a career journey you've had, quite a kind of unique journey. What instigated the change from being a practicing doctor to a practicing pastor, whatever you might call it?
Yeah, thanks, Todd. It's nice to be on. I should have said as we did our very brief hellos earlier that didn't realize this was going to be video as well. You're currently seeing a very unusually clean corner of our lounge right now. Actually, a lot lot noisier than this, but everyone's away, so I've been able to tidy up this corner of the lounge. Not sure I would have said yes if I'd known it was video as well. Video's a bit more exposing, isn't it?
It is.
And look, I've got to say, teaching pastor at St. Paul's is one of my most recent things. I'm not actually currently doing that. I put all roles on hold while I got that doctorate completed.
Okay.
So that was just only a few months ago. I was over in California for a graduation.
Congratulations.
Like that.
And that's understandable. You got to put, I heard the doctors are quite intensive in the amount of time.
Intense towards the end, that's for sure. Mm. And some of what we'll be chatting about today was the final project that I did for that. But yeah, it's been quite a journey, and part of the reason for some of the changes along the way, I returned to faith in my late 20s, mm-hmm. and I'd encourage people who do that later in life not to just jump out of their professions into church-related work. But for me, that became gradually clear that God was asking me to do that, to move out of medicine and into church-related work. And so, yeah, that's almost 20 years ago now. And so I haven't practiced for a long, long time. I'm not safe anymore, Todd, so don't ask.
Okay. I won't ask any questions. You might be out of date on things like that.
I don't trust myself even on my own family anymore, especially on our own family.
Yeah, and you have a wife, and how many kids you have?
Yeah, so married to Julia, and we've got three kids, 13, Eden's 13, Benji's 11, and Sophia's 9.
Yeah. And you're starting a kind of a homeschool collective new school type thing, aren't you and your wife and some others?
That's right. Yeah, my wife Jules and I, we vowed we'd never homeschool our kids, but God had other plans there.
You never make a vow like that.
You never do. No. Within a year of our oldest starting school, Julia just felt really moved to do some home educating. Partly it was just the busyness of our lives at the time. And so she did that. She did that alongside some good friends, realized that it had changed a lot since that maybe our misconceptions of it that we've maybe grown up with. Yeah. And so she's done that for the last, 7 years or so, and done that alongside friends, started a collective about 3 or 4 years ago. And then about 2 years ago, the doors seemed to be opening for them to start a hybrid school. So they've started that just this term, the doors opened. And so that's 3 days of school together and then 2 days educating at home. And so far it's going really well. It's been quite a change from the relaxed starts in the morning to getting out the door by about 7:15 for Julia and three kids 3 days a week. So life's looking a little different at the moment, but it's exciting.
And are you looking for any more enrollees? You want to plug anything right here and now?
Certainly. People can look up Twin Oaks online. I've got to say there's 170 families on the info list right now. So it really has struck a chord with people. So, it's exciting times.
Yeah, cool. And outside of kind of ministry and apologetics and doing youth camps, I know you do, and homeschooling now or whatnot, what else you do, Sam, as kind of to help you relax and recharge? Do you have any hobbies that you enjoy? I know one of them, skateboarding. Sam and I had a good skateboard ride on our electric board.
we did, Todd. Yeah. And I was I was encouraged to see somebody, you know, more my vintage doing skateboarding. I've never been able to do anything in a half pipe, Todd, and now with 51-year-old ankles, I'm not going to be trying to pick that up. But the more relaxed kind of cruising on a longboard and seeing your electric skateboard was just, inspirational. I guess water sports would be the other thing. We, as a family, we just love to be at the beach, near the beach, in the water, on the water. And so one of the presents to myself as I got to the end of the doctorate last summer was to get a boat for the family. And so it's not terribly flash, but it pulls us along on biscuits and
all you need
on board. So that's been a lot of fun.
Awesome, man. Well, listen, today we're going to discuss the topic of emerging adulthood. And Sam, how did you become interested in that as an idea, as a life stage worth studying and writing about?
Yeah. That's a good question. I was working for the Venn Foundation. And so alongside some teaching at St. Paul's, which I've done part-time for a long time, up until the doctorate really got to the pointy end of it, my other main role had been at the Venn Foundation. And again, I put in a plug for the Venn Foundation. They just do some amazing work in the sort of educational and formational space for young adults and older adults too. Their kind of offerings have moved more into later life as that's progressed. But for 11 years, my wife and I were the residential hosts for their fellowship program. And so we got to walk a pretty close journey with between 6 and 12 young adults as they really grappled with how to really integrate faith into all of their life. And they were, many of them had studied at university, but not all. Some had gone into some of the skilled manual trades or some of the creative endeavors into education. And so in all of those areas, we were looking at what does it look like to follow Christ in really fully and to be fully surrendered to him in all of life. And in the exciting parts of life as well, to actually find joy in all sorts of areas of life. I helped a friend around that time to deliver some lectures in a chaplaincy paper. And that paper was really looking at all the life stages. And so really from cradle to grave, this paper was looking at how a human develops through every area of life. And it was in one of the books for that course that I first heard emerging adulthood described. And it really came from a psychologist called Jeffrey Arnett. He published a paper in 2000 where he suggested that just as adolescence had really evolved as a new life stage that was recognized in the 1940s, 50s, and 60s, so there was now a new life stage emerging. That the years of 18 through to 25 had changed so much in a couple of generations that he put forward a hypothesis that we needed to be recognizing that people in those ages were experiencing something quite different to what their parents, their grandparents, and certainly their great-grandparents had experienced. And he put forward five features of that time of life, that it's a time for exploring identity. That's mainly in, to go back to Freud. Freud said that, you know, love, romance, and our wider connectedness, relatedness, and networks there, and our explorations in work and career were really the two main themes of adult life. Arnett actually added a third. He added worldview as a third major theme of identity exploration, that we actually, in that time of life, we sort out what we're going to think about the world. I think that's a great addition. So we explore those things. The second feature was instability. So it's a time where there's quite a bit of instability. People across populations, so if you take the average across populations, people will live in more locations in their third decade of life, so in their 20s. Than they will in any other decade of life. And sometimes for some people, and I think I'd be one of these, they'll live in more locations in their third decade of life than perhaps all the other decades put together. Like,
yeah, I think that's true. Me, yeah. I can say that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So what did that look like for you, Todd? Bit of travel and things thrown in there?
Well, just I had finished my degree at biology and bounced around in Orange County, got married, during that stage, and we bounced around a bit. And so, yeah, there was a lot of change during the decade in my late 20s, early 30s.
I think you throw in there certainly historically that Kiwi sort of sense there that travel's a bit of a rite of passage.
Oh, of course,
that
you
go on the OE, and it's not to London anymore the way that perhaps it was viewed 20 years ago, that you went to London, you did your OE, you know, you went across to the continent a couple of times. I think people are as likely to go perhaps to North America or to somewhere else as part of that, but travel's sort of part of that.
Mm.
The third feature, so that's identity, exploration, instability. The third feature is self-focus. And what Arnett means by that is not self-absorption, although it can become that, but it's just that you're able to make decisions and not ask anyone's permission the way you needed to when you were living at home with mum and dad or dad or guardians. You needed to check in with people to make decisions. And then later in life, when you're perhaps have a partner and you've got, certainly if you've got young family, you need to take all of that into account.
Sure.
But in those emerging adulthood years, you're relatively free from those obligations. You can focus on yourself and you can just say, look, I'm gonna up sticks and move. I can remember doing that. I was working at Whangarei Base Hospital. I heard that they had an exchange program with a hospital in Perth. And a month later, I was working in Perth. And so, you know, I could just do that. I was you know, footloose and fancy free in all senses of that word. You know, I could actually up sticks and move.
Yeah.
And that's what he means by self-focus. Number four is feeling in between. And so emerging adults will often feel as though they're slowly moving into adulthood. If they're asked the question, do you feel you're an adult? Many of them will give you quite an ambiguous answer. They'll give an answer that's a variation of, in some ways, yes, and in some ways, no. Or it depends what you mean by that.
Hmm.
You know, on some days I definitely am. Other days I don't feel it at all. And so there is this feeling that they feel somewhat betwixt and between stages. And as they move through their 20s, more and more, a higher percentage give an unambiguous yes. Like I've reached adulthood. And so the markers of that are more gradual now. That because some of those permanent markers of responsibility, like getting married, having your first child, buying your first home, being, you know, attached to your first mortgage, they're being delayed by up to a decade or more.
Yeah,
now.
Sure.
And so what people have put in their place are things like feeling responsible, making responsible decisions, feeling independent, becoming financially independent, kind of copping the consequences for my decisions, you know, actually fully owning those things. Those things are much more gradual. And so the feeling, not surprisingly, that one's becoming an adult is likewise more gradual. And then the fifth feature, the last feature, is possibilities and optimism. It's a time where you haven't fully burned any bridges. You can actually make some often quite major course corrections, course changes. I'm, again, a bit of a poster boy for that in having, you know, changed from medicine to theology almost overnight. And you know, I can say to you, I basically went back to living on baked beans and two-minute noodles for another year while I went through Bible college, you know?
Yeah.
Now, I would have really wrestled with that decision had I been married to Julia at the time and had our three kids. You know, that would have been the stakes would have been a lot higher. But it's a time where the possibilities are still open. You're really optimistic about the future and you can just dive into pretty much any area of life. You haven't burned any bridges.
Right. So that you've kind of given us an overview then of Jeffrey Jensen Arnett's five stages or five big demarcations of that. And then I've read a little bit of something that you sent to me.
Yes.
Kind of, it seems like you've presented five considerations that correspond to the five, you know, main features of the life stages. And so, I don't know, why don't you briefly list the five that you've listed, and then we'll go back over them and tease them out a bit. Can you do that?
Absolutely. Yeah. So as I came across those five features, I was reading those. Remember, I was, I was doing that paper. So I couldn't actually stop at that stage and really dive into it. But as soon as that paper was over, that chaplaincy paper that I was helping the friend with, I just read the first book from Arnett on it. And I was like, man, all of these features were certainly in my life. I felt like someone was reading my mail, like someone was absolutely just doing an x-ray of my 20s and just showing it up, projecting it into a book. Secondly, everyone going through our Venn program was right in that zone. And then thirdly, some of those features were still present when I was reading that book 10 years ago at 42, you know, like, I was like, these features don't evaporate on your 30th birthday. And so they're a part of our culture more widely.
Sure.
So I became fascinated in that. And in particular, how might we as Christian churches, as Christian communities, help people through this decade of life? Like, what does good support and discipleship look like? And so that's where I boiled down those five. Now, just to confirm, those five don't necessarily map onto the five.
I was
so
wondering helpful. That. Yeah.
They're both lists of five. I've just got five sort of big buckets, I think, that are helpful. And and the first one that I sent through to you was just to come back, I guess, relentlessly and unapologetically to a biblical anthropology, a biblical understanding of the human person. If this is a time to make some explorations, and in some ways I've got a little bit of a problem with the nomenclature that's used in the literature. I'm kind of bound by it because I'm entering into a conversation that's already underway. But when it comes to identity exploration, I do think in wider culture, and we'll come to cultural discernment in a moment because that's my third one, but in wider culture, there's enormous pressure on young adults to manufacture their own sense of identity.
Sure.
To cobble that together. And to look deeply inside yourself. And actually, it's just not a biblical understanding of the human person. In fact, you won't find the word identity used in the New Testament. There's plenty of language in and around who we are as people.
Sure, yeah.
But we see Paul, we see Peter, we see other New Testament writers just absolutely unwavering in their insistence that everything else is to be penultimate to you now being caught up in Christ. That they use language that's, I mean, Jesus uses language. You know, he says to Nicodemus, you must be born again.
Yeah.
And Nicodemus like literally doesn't know what to do with the language. You know, he responds the way my three-year-old might have responded. You know, what am I going to jump back into mummy's tummy and be born again? Like this is radical language in terms of reorienting our sense of self. And so I think one of those exciting explorations that we get to do in that time of emerging adulthood from 18 through to 30 plus is go, what does it look like for Christ to now be absolutely central and absolutely, and all of those other areas of life that I'm excited to explore, my career, my relationships, both platonic, romantic, if they unfold, like everything like that, what does it look like for all of those things to now be submitted and for me to be doing those in relationship with Christ and for him to be able to, do I give him permission to point out all of the ways that I get those things distorted, where I get those things out of perspective, where idolatries set themselves up. So that's the first thing, is to come back and to receive an identity from God.
Yeah, well, that's can sometimes be very cliche or like Christian jargon. You know, your identity has to be rooted in Christ, and you know that is our mantra. But I used to do men's ministry, and there's a real inextricable truth that men do, good, bad, or indifferent, derive a lot of their identity in what they do, what they produce with their hands.
Yes,
you think that's a godly thing? You think that applies to the emerging adults as well? As long as it's submitted under the lordship of Christ, you know, the bricklayer is just as sacred as the one who's preaching in the cathedral, as the reformers said.
Yes, yes. No, I think that's great, Todd. And my supervisor pushed back on this too. I think I was perhaps, I think I said, you know, our identities need to be found in Christ, full stop. And he's like, what do you know, expand out on
that. Yeah, flesh that out.
Someone I've found really helpful. Well, firstly, I think it was Walter Brueggemann that first said this, but many others have said it. He said, you know, questions of identity inevitably become questions of vocation. So part of who I am inevitably needs to work itself out in what I do and in my obligations. And so to just throw out a couple of examples, you know, I'm a New Zealand-born European, and that's part of my identity. It's part of you know who I am, but working out what that means in my family to work out that, you know, to actually find out a bit about our heritage and things, what that means in my really ethnically diverse suburb. I live in Mount Roskill, which certainly historically has been the most ethnically diverse suburb in the country, actually, at certain times.
I didn't know that.
I've got to work out what that means for me to be a European, Kiwi, you know, New Zealand-born male living here in this thing. What does that actually mean? I've got a vocation to outwork in terms of that. And in my increasingly divided nation, like, what does that mean for me to walk that path alongside Christ and to work out, like, Jesus, who do you want me to be? How do you want me to be, given that this is who I am? Like, how does that turn into vocation? Likewise, on the day that Eden was born, I added dad to my identity. You know, I hadn't been a father before, and I'm suddenly, that's a significant part of who I am. But my vocation of working out, like, what does it mean to be a Jesus-following father of Eden, Benjamin, and Sophia, and to do that well, I need to actually do that in partnership with him.
Yeah, yeah.
And,
I know that it's cliche, but the only thing of all what you just named that is never going to change is your identity as a child of God, a son of God, a beloved of God. And I know that does sound cliche, but boy, it doesn't matter. Doesn't mean it's not true, right?
Yeah. And I think we, in my experience, I think we start to know we're getting things slightly out of whack when God puts his finger on something and says, I want you to let that go. So when he said to me, you know, I actually want you to let medicine go, I just wasn't aware how much of my identity had been maybe wrapped up in some unhealthy ways.
I can only imagine. I mean, doctors have the stigma of having everything wrapped up in their title, Dr. So-and-so, and the financial trappings that might come with that in some instances and whatnot. That would be very easy to get wrapped up in that.
Yeah, it is. And just one quick example to show you how subtle this is, Todd. But, you know, you people say, oh, introduce you, oh, Sam, you're a doctor. But I actually found that within church life, if I wasn't careful, I could tell the story of giving up medicine with so much flourish that earned me a sort of a certain cachet of a different type. And I had to be really careful that I wasn't
humble,
seeking
humble
out.
Dr. Sam Bloy.
That's right. Oh, man, you know, look at this guy. He's kind of, so it's subtle. Like, only the Lord, right, you know, see, it talks about the word being able to divide between joint and marrow, the intents of the heart. Like, the Lord, the Spirit knows how to get right in there and show us when we've got those things out of whack. So I absolutely agree with you. It's a capitulation of another kind. It's unacceptable for us to not put God at the center, but it's also unacceptable for us just to say, God's at the center. My identity is in Christ. Full stop. That's it. I don't have to
think about
it. We live our lives working out in relationship with him what that actually means.
Okay. Yeah. Fair enough. Well, let's move on then to our second main big rock in the bucket, saints and exemplars. I'll just bring out the title for you.
Yeah.
What is that? Right. That sounds a bit
saints,
know,
and exemplars
out there.
So look, in that I was really trying to capture some of the what the literature was pointing to, but also some of what my experience had shown me. I didn't read a book on emerging adults that didn't have a chapter on mentoring. I think I might be able to go back into the garage bookshelf and find one. But everyone said that this is really, really important.
Do you think it's more important at this stage than others, or it's just more lacking at this stage than others, or neither?
Yeah. Look, that's a really good question. I think it's important. It's perhaps more important because people have looked at it and realized that it's lacking. Then people sort of come out the other end of youth group where there's been quite a bit of support, and they just, sometimes that support just drops off a cliff, and people in church life perhaps don't know what to do with you, don't know how to position you in certain ways. That's often because this group is quite diverse as well. So people within perhaps church life, less so outside of it, but people still getting married at 21 within church life, and others who aren't going to get married for another decade and a half or if at all. And so this kind of interesting time from sort of 20 through to 30 is can be quite a wide-ranging and diverse group of people. And so sometimes it's difficult to know what exactly is needed. And so churches sometimes like, I'll wait until I'm asked. And there's something to be said for that. There's also something to be said for continuing to invite young adults into your world. And I think people who are married and have got their sort of tight nuclear family unit, oftentimes, you know, the drawbridge is up and they're just trying to survive. And sometimes I think there'd be much to be gained by including and continuing some of that more intergenerational, and not sort of right up to, not necessarily saying that it all has to be done with just the those who are 10 years older or whatever. It can be 20 years older, 30 years older, just reintroducing some of that intergenerational connection.
Yeah. Well, how do you do it? How do you do it? I'll use that generation's term, organically. In other words, you're not going to have a bunch of old people like me go up and say, I'm your new mentor or whatever. But also, a lot of times the young people aren't going to ask for it. Sometimes you don't know what you don't know. You don't know what you need and don't have.
Yeah. Gosh, there's so much in this, Todd. I feel like we could almost do a whole podcast on this, because there was just so many different variables in it. So some of it is that because I think young adults feel two sort of reluctances. One is that there are some narratives that say you should have this together by now, so don't go asking for any help. So there is a bit of that. It's like you should have it together. You should be doing okay. Sometimes there's a reluctance because they've actually looked at those who are older and gone, either they don't understand me. And so to your point there, doing the caricature of like, hey, listen up, let me tell you how it was in my days. I think mentors need to do a lot of listening, because culture has changed a lot. And some of this, I mean, I should have said I'm going to be throwing out certain things, but this is changing for me all the time, particularly when I speak to groups of young adults. They often ask questions that are really, really good. And someone asked me a couple of weeks ago, they said, if this has changed so much, if culture's changing so much, and if this life stage has changed so much, are mentors even going to understand where we're at? Like, are they going to be able to mentor us? And it was a really good question. And what we teased out, we actually had a coffee later on, was that there's a difference between some of those aspects of the human condition that have always been and always will be, versus the backdrop against which those things are playing out.
Oh, that's good. Yeah.
And I think the mentor needs to actually do a lot of listening. Like, what does this look for you? How can I be of help? Can I resource you in any ways? Let's just talk about those things and flesh them out a bit.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I know I'm jumping down to the very last part of what I was going to ask in the interview, but how do you marry that practically? How do you join those two demographics of people together? I mean, my wife and I, we used to run the young adults. This was a few years back, the young adults at our church. And, you know, it was anybody who wanted to just kind of naturally came in, and we, you know, mentored some of them. But would that be one natural inroad as young adults?
I think so. I think providing as many opportunities as possible for people to just naturally rub shoulders a little bit. And, you know, I mean, I've had people who are sort of further down the line than me, or in a different stage of life to me. So I can remember when I was in my early, late 20s, and a friend who wasn't that much older than me, but had got married a lot earlier, and they had a couple of, you know, toddlers. I can remember saying, they invited me over for dinner, and him saying, I said, what time should I come over? He said, you know, kids will be down by 7, so come just after that. I was like, heck no, I'm turning up at 6. Like, I want to be part of bath time and read a few books and rack them up and sort of be the crazy uncle a little bit. I wanted to be a part of a life stage that I currently wasn't in. And so I think inviting people into your world a little bit, letting the drawbridge down, you know, I've tidied up for you guys today, but letting them see your home with piles of washing on the side and things, and just seeing how you're doing life at a different stage. I think connecting with those who are older, who have come perhaps full circle. And, you know, I don't think I've ever been mentored by somebody where absolutely every area of their life I absolutely agreed with or wanted to emulate. You know, that'd be crazy if you did meet someone like that. But
yeah,
there's always a lot to be gained by those kinds of relationships that start organically, and you begin to learn about each other.
hopefully our generation still has some cred, you know, some credibility with these younger people, because they tend to be very suspicious of authority and authority figures, and probably even some resentful. You know, we've been blamed for ruining the climate, ruining the planet. So they might be a bit skeptical about taking advice from us if we haven't done it well.
My supervisor, a guy called Stephen Argue, wrote a book. The woman called Kara Powell, they co-authored it together. It was called Growing With, a really good book. If anyone's listening to this and they're parenting teens and emerging adults, a really good book called Growing With. And they opened that up by sort of describing a meme that went around. It was hashtag how to confuse a millennial. And they sort of said, you know, hashtag how to confuse a millennial, give them a dial-up phone and tell them to call, you know, things like that. It was like just poking fun at how much things had changed. Uh-huh. But the millennials kind of fought back and they started coming up with their own quite, you know, cynical hashtags. And they said, how to confuse a millennial, ruin the economy, give them minimum wage, tell them to buy a house. You know, like there are some things where they're coping with some things that they didn't ask for. And I don't mean millennials. Millennials aren't emerging adults now. We're talking Gen Z.
Yeah, Gen Z, yeah.
So that meme's been around for a while. Mm. But any time in my paper, my tone started to shift to blaming emerging adults for the, or laying the full blame at their feet. My supervisor pushed back really hard. Mm. He said, many of them are inheriting a world that they didn't ask for. Mm. Even some of these features, they didn't create them. They didn't put them out there. And even some things where we talk about, you know, maybe pick on one like entitlement.
Yeah.
This is an entitled generation.
Yeah, I've heard that over and over and over.
Yeah. Everyone gets a trophy. Well, as one of the authors I read said, they weren't handing themselves out trophies. Someone was handing out the trophies. They didn't do this to themselves, you know, like,
okay.
So it's a bit of a sort of a...
Didn't happen in a vacuum, right?
Didn't happen in a vacuum, yeah.
Mm. Mm, yeah. So, all right. Well, for time's sake, let's move on to number three then, helping them discern the culture. So our first one was finding their identity in Christ. Second one was the need for role models and mentors and people that'll just share life with them and do life with them. And thirdly, then the need for cultural discernment. Unpack that for us. Yeah.
Yeah. When I was growing up, Todd, I heard this almost like a modern day parable, really, that bank tellers don't learn how to identify counterfeit notes by studying counterfeits. They do it by studying real money.
Yeah.
And they just have so much real money pass under their fingers that they just intuitively know when a counterfeit comes across the till, the desk at the bank. And I remember hearing that. I must have been in my teens when I first heard that, and I heard it multiple times through youth group. It's probably still doing the rounds, that parable. And I remember thinking at the time, because the implication was, you know, just bury yourself in prayer and the word, and you'll just know counterfeits immediately when you see them. Just study the genuine. And I can remember at the time just thinking, wow, that's just a really great point. It's a really great. But the older I've got, the more I've started to question it. Now, I actually think it's terrible advice. An author I read recently actually even interviewed a bank teller, and they said, a bank expert, and they said, no, we actually do get our tellers alongside studying real money. They actually study counterfeits too, because the counterfeits can be so close that you need to be able to have certain things to look for and set those two things up side by side.
Yeah. So it's been an urban myth from day one we got in our youth group, an urban legend.
Well, look, to be clear, the myth isn't study the original and study the authentic and study the true, the good and the beautiful. Like, we should continue to do that.
Sure.
But alongside that, we should actually be looking at some counterfeits, and we should be saying to young adults, so tell me more about this whole idea that you can be whoever you want to be, and, you know, the Disney sort of trope that this is the, you know who you are best and your best self, and just look inside yourself. You can do anything, be anything. Let's just study that. Let's just scratch beneath the surface. Let's hold that up alongside a biblical account of the human person. One of the saddest statistics, I think, that I came across, and this, again, to be clear, is not looking at Christian populations, but more broadly, is that there was some real pessimism around whether people were being equipped to even be able to come back to first principles and identify a moral dilemma. To be able to identify a moral dilemma, regardless of whether they landed, you know, whether they landed on this side of it or that side of it, just being able to identify that there was something at stake to really wrestle with and grapple with. Instead, what they found was that there was a remarkable confidence that I'll just be able to follow my gut in the moment and I'll know what to do. Won't have had to really think it through. I won't have really had to logically look at it, break it down into its kind of component parts, lay the base of an argument or a foundation. I'll just know in the moment what to do. So long as the outcome is good, quote unquote, whatever good means, you know, like, yeah. You know, so long as the outcome's good, particularly good for me, and so long as no one else is harmed along the way.
Right.
Again, that just kicks the can down the road. Like, what does harm actually mean? But those were sort of the three things that were just guiding them, that I'll know in the moment, I'll look at the outcome long term if it's good, and so long as it's harming no one else, because our morals are private. They're private to me. They're private to you. You don't get to judge me. You do you. I don't get to judge you. I do me. And that was really the sum total of the moral foundations and ability to morally reason that most people were getting. Now, happily, I think, hopefully, churches are doing better than that. And this is where I'll put in a plug for you guys.
There you go. Yeah.
Thinking does
matters.
Being able to think things through, being able to logically look at something and say, you know, what does this mean? What are the, let's follow that through to its logical conclusion.
Yeah. It seems like more so in the younger generation, facts and absolute truth are juxtaposed and in conflict with, you know, lived experiences and people's own narratives and people's own opinions and whatnot. And it just, to me, maybe I've just always been the logical thinking type, and I can't get it. I just don't get it. It's crazy to me, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So that's really what I've just put out there to churches, to Christian communities. Be places where people can wrestle with things. Where you're not afraid to actually grapple with that. And if you don't have someone in-house to do it, because, you know, not all churches can have an expert on this and an expert on that, find people who are, you know, ask young adults if they're grappling with something to be patient. Hey, be patient while we find some space to be able to deal with that.
Yeah.
Don't answer it with things like, you know, oh, don't let your head get in the way of your heart. Just believe and go forth, you know. The Christian faith has always been able to absorb the big gnarly questions of life. It's been able to do that throughout its 6,000 Judeo-Christian year history, right? Now is no exception. We've got some big thorny issues that we're grappling with.
Do you think there certainly has to be some real sensitivity to it. An apologist like myself, who's very fat, I love the facts and stuff. I've got to be very sensitive to not be dismissive, right? Or, you know, elitist, like, well, here's the way things really are.
Yeah.
You're living in the matrix. You want to get unplugged or not? Which pill do you want?
Red or blue? Right. Yeah. Well, there's a story I've heard, and I haven't actually tracked it down and read it for myself, but attributed to Chesterton, that when he was debating, I think it was Bertrand Russell. Did him and Bertrand Russell have some debates in the past? It might have been someone else.
Not sure.
I might not even be putting people together from the same vintage. But that he would lose debates on purpose. In other words, he would lose them so winsomely that the crowd would, in losing that particular battle, he'd win the war, if you like. He'd win hearts over. I guess what I'm saying by that is posture really matters. How we posture ourselves in those conversations really matters. I don't think anyone ever, and I certainly have never enjoyed being made to look like an idiot. And so even if I feel like I'm in possession of some information that if only the person I was interacting with would have it, they too would see. I try to deliver that information as winsomely as possible so that we both might come out the end of it, the other side of it, feeling like we gained something. Because I didn't come up with that myself. There was a time when someone winsomely delivered it to me. I didn't come out of the womb knowing that. So it's right. All secondhand. And yet some of us, we, and myself included, I'll sometimes tout information like I'm the original owner or thinker of it. And that's not the case. And so I think being able to do that as generously as possible is helpful.
Good. It's good attitude and all. Moving on, number four, help them provide with some stability and opportunities and service as your fourth point. Tease that out.
Yeah. So it's an unstable time of life, right? We've compared notes at how much we moved around during that time of life. It can be really unstable. You know, it's not an exaggeration to say that in that couple of years, and sometimes in the same three-month period of, you know, turning 18, whatever the final year of high school was, one might leave home, start a new job or study or apprenticeship, move cities, sometimes even countries, begin a relationship.
Survive a pandemic. You know, on it goes.
You know, start a relationship, end a relationship. You might be going out with your high school sweetheart and you move to the other side of the world. You know, just all of those things can happen at once. Move churches.
Yeah.
And so one of the things that I do ask emerging adults is what are the anchor points? What are the things that you're actually keeping in your life that are the same? And one of the quotes I'll sometimes put up is an interview I did with one of our Venn participants. Todd, I had the privilege of being able to interview 42 of those who went through our Venn program over that time. And much of what I'm sharing with you comes courtesy of them. It's not stuff I came up with. It's not stuff I learned in a book. It's them just very graciously sharing their own experiences in their lives. And she said she was changing courses. She was changing her living situation. All of the stuff was up for grabs. She chose to stay in the same church at that time. She could have moved. There was a lot of pressure to move. There were churches that were, you know, she described that they were cooler. They had more people my age. But she said, I felt that at a time of life where everything else was shifting, I needed to be able to walk in the door on a Sunday morning and have not just my parents there, but, excuse me, three or four other people who have known me for a decade and can eyeball me and ask me how I'm really going. And so it might not be church that you leave the same, but what's something that's going to anchor you in that time?
I heard a statistic that if you don't, when a young adult goes to a university, and they're living, you know, outside of home or whatever, if they don't re-engage in church within the first, I think it's 6 months, then there's a great, great chance and probability that they won't.
Right.
At least not for a very long time. And maybe that has to do with the anchor. They just, without the anchor, you drift away.
That's right. Yeah. And those things can be, I think those things can be helped to be set up ahead of time too. So again, one of the alarming statistics Again, this is not church, but this is in other settings, that many emerging adults, as they leave home, if they're asked who an older friend is, really only have their parents. They can't point to any older people who know who they are. And even within churches, there's probably less of that than there should be. And so Julia and I are really trying now to be intentional and to say, okay, for our kids, who are some people that we're going to almost act as matchmakers for? and you know, again, we don't want to control our kids' lives, but when they really seem to gel with someone who comes around for dinner, say, hey, you know what, let's us shout you guys to go to out somewhere for lunch three times a year.
These so are other young adults their age or somebody that's in just a larger a higher age group.
None of this is idealistic and hasn't fully taken shape,
materialized,
but a bit of both, Todd. So maybe someone who's 10 years older than them, but also someone who's 30 or 40 years older than them.
Okay.
Yeah. And say, you know what, at least twice, three times a year, go out for lunch with that person. We'll shout, just go out, hang with them, ask them lots of questions so that when the time comes and you do leave home, there's a couple of people who can just pick up the phone in that first 6 months of uni, maybe once a month, and just check in. And it doesn't feel weird. It doesn't feel contrived or just set up in that moment. There's some cap. There's some relational capital in the bank that they can draw on in that time.
Great. That's great. Yeah. I recall there was a pastor friend of mine down in the Christchurch region, and his son is he was in his late teens. I got to know him a bit, and he'd come up to Auckland, and he would just pour his heart out to me. Some stuff that he was going through, he hadn't told anybody, and I didn't work that hard to gain his trust. But it's like, you know, he was craving for that, you know, some anchor, basically. Maybe he felt like he was drifting. Don't know. Wow.
Yep. And so the service part of that really, again, is an insight from one of the interviewees, and she said she had moved cities. She'd moved churches, she'd changed courses, everything was up for grabs. So even the church was new.
Yeah.
And she said, I realized that I needed to volunteer in an area where I was going to be missed if I didn't show up, because there were so many things that I could take or leave. I didn't have to turn up to my lectures if I didn't want to. I could just, you know, get the handout, read the chapter in the textbook, sleep in if I wanted. Even in church, she said, when I was part of the choir, I could text them on Sunday morning and say, hey, I'm not going to be in the choir. And the choir would just drop down from 30 to 29 and no one would care. But she said, when I volunteered to help lead a group of 11-year-old girls, I'd know that they'd miss me if I wasn't there to church that morning. And so she said, I realized I needed to voluntarily place myself somewhere where I was going to be missed. Everywhere else, my flat, we could come and go and ships in the night. Now, obviously, we'd have meals together and we had relationship there. Now, I'm a bit reluctant to put service in there because I know service, we've got some, you know, well-known cases in the last decade here in New Zealand of churches maybe abusing that whole idea of serving in church life. And so I realize it can be fraught. And so I guess my appeal is to young adults to look for healthy, pray about healthy ways that you can serve.
In churches, you know, make sure that you're not sending out any vibes of abuse and free slave labor type of thing, and
100%
and that, yeah.
And it doesn't even have to be within church life, you know. I think you could you could volunteer somewhere at a not-for-profit as well, where you're just sort of, you're turning up and you actually it's acting as a marker point. Every week I do this.
Great, love it. All right, moving right on. We're on our fifth one. Experience and encounter, you label it as, and you say, you know, everybody's got to see, taste and see that the Lord is good. What about that?
Again, this is something that I guess I've come to see through my own life, and again through the testimony of others that I've chatted to, others that I've interviewed. And that is really to go alongside all of the others, because, you know, we can really, you know, what do I call the first one? Biblical anthropology. We sort of dive on it and we read up heaps on it, you know, cultural discernment, dive on in there and read up all about it. I guess I've seen a lot of people drift away from God for two main reasons. One is that the churches they were a part of were all about experience and encounter, and often in some quite shallow and manufactured ways that mean that they didn't have anything else. There was nothing of substance to their right. faith. And so for them, they need to know this is a substantive faith. And there's as much intellectual integrity here as the rabbit hole's as deep as you want to go down, you know.
take that
pill and you'll go deep into the matrix.
Yeah.
But for others, perhaps they did plenty of that, but it was, I guess it's been a long time since they were, if ever, they were in a situation where they really knew that God knew them, that God calls us by name. And we don't do that secondhand, that Jesus eyeballs Peter and says, who do you say that I am?
Right.
And he knows him. He renames him in that moment. And so I guess an experience and encounter, you know, are they spectacular? You know, usually not, actually. They can be. And when that happens, I think I could probably count on maybe two fingers the number of times that God has absolutely blown me away in ways where I'm kind of like, wow. it'd be hard not to believe in you in those moments, God. But in our maturing, God doesn't want us having those time and time again. And one of the things in some of the churches I've been a part of, I would see an almost immature addiction to want to get a high again,
yeah,
or do this or do that.
Yeah.
Again, it's happened very rarely to me, but much more common has been as I've just sat quietly in a moment, maybe read a passage of scripture that I've read a number of times, maybe so much so that I've become over familiar with it. I might be listening. I listen to the Lectio 365 app occasionally. And hearing that read by someone else, perhaps given a slightly different gloss on it by them, suddenly that verse, that passage, that encouragement or challenge lands in a way that I go, man, God, you meant me to get that this morning. And no one else could have known what I was lying awake early this morning thinking,
wow,
about, but you did. And you just caused that to be delivered to me in certain ways.
Well, it sounds like this category of allowing them to experience or fostering an experience, an encounter with the Lord, that's a slippery bar of soap, because it's going to look and feel differently for everybody. If you probably interviewed 10 people, if you encountered the Lord with just those two times, yes, once was when I was rock climbing, or once when I was in worship, or once when I was in quiet prayer, or once when I was in the Word or in seminary or whatever. So corral that? How do we foster that for emerging adults?
Yeah. I think it's, I've never read back to back Charles Taylor's The Secular Age. I've dipped in and out of that book, but I have read James K.A. Smith did a sort of a Taylor for Idiots, an Idiot's Guide to Taylor. And I read that. And in that, he talks about our disenchantment, that we're sort of missing who God is, both out of subtraction and addition. So we've subtracted God out of certain places. We've taken him out of the public square. We've pulled these things back. We're not doing these certain things. We've also thrown in a whole heap of other stuff that's just choked us. And we're just absolutely full up to the eyeballs. And so my encouragement would be for us sometimes to unplug, to take some stuff out. I don't know, take a day off work. And, you know, we just down the road here, we're a bit lucky. We've got the St. Francis Retreat Center on our road here, just down Hillsborough Road.
Huh.
They will run a silent retreat once a month. And for $60, you can book in a day. You can meet with one of their spiritual directors and just have a quiet day. It may not look like that. It may look like something completely different. But just to allow a bit of space, I think, for God to do whatever he's going to do, however he's going to.
You know, I was caught off guard about a month ago. My wife organized, it was organized at the church. My wife put it together. We had a prayer in different slots from like Friday night all the way to Sunday morning. And everybody had a half hour slot. And the room was dark. And there was, dim lighting and a little bit of soft music and just stations of, here's thankfulness and here's, you know, supplication and here's, she had five different stations. And I walked in there and I'm not an emotionally driven guy at all, but I could just feel the presence of God. There was something sacred about it. It caught me off guard, but it was really beautiful. It really was.
Yeah.
Oh.
And I don't want to set up a dichotomy either, or a dualism between experiencing and encountering the Lord and the intellectual stuff that I was talking about. And a friend of mine years ago said, I think people have forgotten that study can be a charismatic experience. And he would just describe, he's a very, very thinky person. You know, if you're thinking, you know, Myers-Briggs, he's a thinker rather than a feeler. He's not an emotionally driven person. He's a thinking person. He said, I'd be sitting there in a textbook, scrambling to get an assignment done and just find myself moved to tears by the way that a commentator is commenting on a passage or something, you know, or the way that something's being described. And so study itself can be, those intellectual pursuits can be some of the ways that God will just encounter us.
Do you think that's tailored to the individual, the personality and the, you know?
Yeah. I think so. I think God's really generous that way. I think he sometimes comes to us, or he often comes to us the way that we're wired. I think though he sometimes thwarts our unspoken demands that he break in. Okay? And what I mean by that is, well, God, you know, I'm doing my thing. And if you want to get my attention, you just come in hot and loud enough for me to know. And he's like, no, I'm actually not going to do that. I'm going to wait until you create some space. I'm going to wait until you slow down and I don't have to scream at you.
Yeah. You know, I grew up a little of my background in kind of the Pentecostal charismatic churches and stuff. And it was all about experiencing the Holy Spirit. And did you feel that? And do you feel his presence? And I kind of just faked it along for a long time because I'm not the feeling type. And the whole, oh, you know, Christianity is not a religion. It's a relationship. And Jesus would be your closest friendship and stuff. And I couldn't sell that. I mean, I do a lot of kids camps down in Raglan, and we see lots of kids come to Jesus, but I don't promise them that they're going to feel the warm and fuzzies, that Jesus is going to be like, I'm talking to you. I talk to you, you respond, and back and forth. I can't push what I haven't experienced like that. And so, yeah, empty and promises.
And to be completely clear, I've never had that, Todd, in terms of, I remember reading a book by a very prophetic guy whose ministry I really admired. And he said, people talk about this like it's a telephone conversation. And he said, it is just not. And people who talk in those terms can do a great disservice.
Well, I think so.
And make people feel a huge disappointment.
It's one thing, if you have that experience, great. I envy that, but don't sell it that, you know, you've heard I don't know if you've heard this before. It's like there's radio waves everywhere. We just have to put up an antenna.
God's
always trying to talk with you. Isn't your natural father? And it can do damage. I agree. You can think, what's wrong with me? That's what I thought for the longest time. What's wrong with me? Or what's wrong with God? You know, it wasn't until I kind of got involved with apologetics that I realized there was a branch of Christendom that valued thinking and rationality.
Yes.
Study and whatnot. And I thought, God can use people like me.
Yes.
You know?
And that he comes to us in our thoughts. A couple of mornings ago, I was sitting just outside the window I'm looking out here, and I was in a chair, and I was looking at a blackbird was sitting up in a tree. And I just sat looking. We've had a blackbird come back many summers, but I think this might be an offspring of that original one. I think the old one might be gone. This might be the new guard.
Okay.
And I was just sitting watching, and its mouth just opened and then closed. Not a sound came out. And I was like, that blackbird just yawned. So I jumped on my phone, and I Googled, do birds yawn? And it said, yes, they do. And then I was like, do blackbirds yawn? Like, yes, they do. Like, birds will sit there and just take an extended breath of a yawn. And I was like, oh my goodness. And I just sat there and wondered that, like, here's a little bird just having a little rest on a tree, just giving a little yawn. And it was the most profound moment, Todd, honestly. And the Lord spoke to me through a blackbird having a yawn, just about me being a creature too and needing to slow down at times and rest in his presence and listen and take in the creation around me. And so, you know, I'm not saying God didn't need to have a telephone conversation with me about it and say it to me directly.
Right.
He used me sitting quietly, seeing that thing, jumping on Google of all places to just find out some quite delightful stuff about the world he's made and come at me that way.
That's awesome. So if you could, in closing, we're kind of landing the plane here, approaching the hour mark, but if you could, like, if you were to take over a church or take over the young adults, emerging adults part of it, what would be kind of the first change you'd make? You listed five things that are important. Where would you go first? What would be the first thing you'd do, Sam?
Yeah, I mean, I've got to be really careful with this. I actually was, many, many years ago, I was invited to join the team of a church and be in control of the service. And I thought, all right, finally my chance to really just change this thing up. But as I sat and looked at it, I thought, man, there are some reasons that the church looks the way that it does. There's a lot of collected wisdom already there. It doesn't need me to sit there and kind of flip it on its head. So I want to be really cautious. And everything I've said so far, you know, I'm really just hoping that this acts as just a bit of a conversation starter for people. People will be in their own settings and their own environments. I think the first thing I'd do, even maybe coming up line from the five, every time I've spoken on this and I ask, you know, what sort of things will be helpful, the first thing I put up on screen is conversations like this. So actually having a conversation and increasing everyone's understanding of this as a life stage. And so I think that's probably where I'd go first in terms of how best to support and disciple people who are 18 to 29, 30 plus, is that we actually increase our understanding in church life.
Be your first sermon then. Yeah, you have a PowerPoint slide deck and everything and all that stuff.
Yeah, I do. And there's lots of information out there. I'm happy for people to reach out. I can put them in touch with resources. If, you know, they're keen to chat more about it, really happy to do that. There's lots out there, really good stuff. Got a couple of might even throw them out there now, a couple of great book recommendations. One's called Spiritual Formation for Emerging Adults. So Sertran and Kiesling wrote that book. Spiritual Formation for Emerging Adults. It was about 12, 13 years ago, but it's a really good book, covers a lot of ground. And one called Growing With, which I mentioned earlier. So that's for people who are involved in that, particularly parents as well. Good place to start.
Yeah. I was going to ask you, you know, a piece of advice you'd give a 22, 23, 24-year-old that feels completely lost, you know, at the time. But I guess that would be very context, you know. You'd have to get into their life and say, did you stray from the Lord or what? Yeah.
Yeah, if they're feeling lost, I just trying to think of someone that you trust, someone that you used to trust, and reach out to them and reach out. You can reach out, you can reach back a long way. You'll be thinking, if you're 22 and you're like, man, I'm really lost, I'd love someone to chat to, and the only person you can think of you last saw when you were 12, mm-hmm. you'll be going, I can't ask them. You know, I was 12 when I last saw them. But if they were 30 then, they're only 40 now. Like that's a blip for them. If they were 50 then, they're only 60 now. Like they're gonna remember you, they're gonna be thrilled that you got back in touch with them. And that actually happened to me. I bumped into as I was dating Julia, I bumped into a guy at church that I hadn't seen since I was 10 or 11. And so we had coffee after church. Jules and I had been dating for a number of months. I was getting frustrated with certain things about her. And so we sat and had this coffee. And I think I spent about 45 minutes grizzling about her. And at the end of that time, he just looked at me and he said four words. He said, "That's all you, bro." In other words, that's all those problems you're naming are all you.
That's funny. It was brilliant. You did that. Yeah.
It was brilliant. And he knew me well enough. He'd known me from a little kid. He knew me well enough. And he'd listened patiently for 45 minutes while I sort of talked about stuff. Now, Todd, he tuned me up. If I'd been weeping about some other area of brokenness in my life, he wouldn't have responded in that way.
Of course,
right?
Yeah.
He would have responded more pastorally. But just reach out to someone that you trust, who you used to know really well, and just book in a lunch, book in a coffee, book in a beer, have a yarn with them, and just just feel the grace of someone older and wiser, and who's still with the Lord, and just the Lord ministering to you through them.
Cool. One of the questions I tend to ask all of my guests on the show here is what's one thing, Sam, that you do, a spiritual practice or discipline, that helps bring a vibrancy to your walk with the Lord, or restore your vibrancy, or keep you from kind of just growing stagnant? Is there any one thing that you can think of?
Yeah, our church will regularly have times of ministry. Times where we can go forward and ask someone in the church just to pray with us.
Mm-hmm.
And I do that regularly. And I do that. I did that even in the years where I was contributing as a teaching pastor in our church. I mean, I still preach there from time to time. But and so I don't go forward on weeks where I've been preaching, because I'm often part of the team that's doing the praying and the ministering on those times. But actually go forward and I invite someone else to stand with me and to pray with me in the thing that I'm going through. And that can sometimes be really challenging if I'm going through a tough time. Sometimes I just go forward because I'm like, I actually just need to be have someone else hear me give thanks for this thing, and to listen to the confession of gratitude with me on that. So it's involving another one of the saints, allowing the body to be what Paul promised it would be, you know, that we'd minister to each other in that way.
Wow, that's beautiful. I think you're the first person that hasn't given me the cliche, oh, reading the Bible and worshiping and whatnot. So, you know, a cry for community and relationship. My wife and I are on the prayer team, and it breaks my heart. And it's like sometimes week after week, we're just standing there. No one comes up for anything. It's like, is there a self-sufficiency or a pride? I just don't know what it is. But I think that's, you know, it's to see it in that light, that it can help bring communion with God when you're communing with other saints.
Yeah.
Beautiful stuff. Well, Sam, thanks for joining me on the show. I think it's been a great podcast. You've shared your vulnerability and your thoughts. And I think you've, you know, touched on a vulnerable segment of the Christian society there that, and you've given some wise insights there. Where can people find your preachings or teachings or talks or writings? Is there any place I can, you know, refer them to?
Yeah, I mean, I don't have a whole lot that's kind of kept in one place or space. I mean, I do speak at churches from time to time, so people can find that. I mean, my email is just blore.sam@gmail.com. People could just flick me an email if they want some stuff, want some resources. I'm happy to fire some through their way or put them in touch with specific talks that I've done in the past that have been recorded and things. Often, if I'm doing something around emerging adults, it goes from chat through to Q&A. And so I'm a bit nervous about recording all of that because it's often bespoke to the area or the community, the group that you're talking with. But there are ways that I can put you in touch with some of that stuff.
Beautiful. Thanks for that. So be sure to subscribe to the Thinking Matters podcast so you don't miss any of our future episodes where we'll be talking to interesting people like Dr. Sam Blore. Hope to see you later on. God bless.
For more reasons why we believe,
or to support this ministry, go to
thinkingmatters.org.nz.